Thank you very much, Siv, and thank you for all of you who survived for surviving this long. What I want to talk about today is something that has engaged my attention and my energy levels for about 30 years. And I first became interested in this in 1975. And when it was pointed out to me that there were a number of interesting hematological diseases that had a very strong oscillatory character to them, with periods ranging from weeks to months. And I found that quite intriguing, and it was particularly intriguing to me because of my interest in modeling the regulation of cell reproduction. My initial interest had been looking at reproduction of cells in breast tissue, but I certainly had nowhere near the kinds of experimental data that were available from the hematological diseases, and so I very quickly switched. And so what I'd like to do today is to try to take you through a number of these diseases, in every case rather briefly, and I'll give references when it were appropriate, and you can go take a look at the primary sources. But I think it's interesting because it shows how a combination of clinical and laboratory data in conjunction with relatively realistic mathematical models can actually offer insight into some quite interesting clinical problems. So just so you have an idea of where I'm going to go, I'm going to first of all tell you a little bit about how blood cells are produced, and I'm going to quote some numbers for you, which I hope you'll find as astonishing as I did when I first did the calculations, and then talk about how the control of blood cell production actually takes place. And then I'm going to tell you about two different kinds of hematological disease. One I've classified as peripheral diseases, and that what I mean by that will become clear in the course of the talk. And then the other class of diseases are stem cell in origin, and that the distinguishing characteristics between those two, I think, will become clear. Now, for those of you who have forgotten your high school biology or who never took high school biology like myself, I'll remind you that there are three major types of blood cells in our bodies, in all mammalians. Red blood cells are shown here, typical sort of biconcave disc. Here's a white cell or a neutrophil. Here are two platelets. You see the little pseudopodic filaments coming out of the platelets. The red cells are responsible for oxygenating all the tissue in your body. White cells, including the lymphocytes, are responsible for fighting off infection, dealing with various kinds of antigens that show up that you don't want to be having around. And the platelets keep you from essentially leaking to death, because if it wasn't for platelets and their clotting mechanisms, we would just be a big bag of sort of amorphous liquid sloshing around, because they maintain the integrity of our bodies. Now, if you actually sit down and calculate what the lifetime, what a 70-year production of blood cells is for a human being, it's pretty astonishing. So if you consider a typical 70-kilogram human being, and I don't know where that figure comes from, because not very many people are 70 kilos. I haven't been 70 kilos for quite a few years. And assuming that I live for 70 years, then in the course of that lifespan, I'm going to produce about half a metric ton of red blood cells. 160 kilograms of white cells and 30 kilograms of platelets. So that means that I'm going to produce almost 700 kilos of red cells, white cells, and platelets in 70 years, which means that I'm going to effectively reproduce my body weight just in terms of hematopoietic cells every decade of my life. I think that is an absolutely astonishing figure. When you go into a hematology book and they tell you, 10 of the 12 cells produced per day, you can't really relate to that. It's like the Canadian national debt. Which is why politicians put it that way. They don't want you to relate to it. But when you actually translate hematopoietic production to something that we can relate to, like weight, it's mind-boggling. And the thing that is really mind-boggling to me is that this cellular replication takes place in such an absolutely flawless way most of the time. Very few people in this room will actually ever die of hematological disease. They'll die of heart attack or stroke or respiratory distress or something else, but you won't die of a hematopoietic disease probably, which means that in spite of this incredible cell replication, and with that cell replication, the attendant possibility for mistakes being made in the replication of DNA and the transcriptional translational processes, there are mechanisms in place that will make sure that those mistakes are eliminated or corrected. And so the hematopoietic reproduction system is a marvelous example, I think, of a finely engineered control system that works pretty darn well. Now, experimental hematologists don't do experiments on humans for obvious reasons, and what they do experiments on are typically mice. The mouse is the favorite experimental animal that experimental hematologists use, and I just want to contrast the figures here on the left with what production looks like in the mouse, because it offers a slight cautionary note for people who are interested in trying to extrapolate from the mouse to the man. Because we produce our body weight every 10 years, which means we produce 7 times our body weight in 70 years if that's a normal lifespan. A mouse only produces 60% of their body weight in their entire lifetime. The hematopoietic system in the mouse, from a quantitative standpoint, is structured completely differently than it is for the human being. And what that means in terms of trying to translate insight that we get from mouse experiments to the human situation is completely and totally unclear as far as I'm concerned. But I think we should not glibly assume that we can just, you know, use some kind of allometric scaling law to go from a mouse who weighs a few grams to a human who weighs 70 kilograms. Now, when you look at a hematology book trying to understand exactly how blood cells are produced, it tends to be a little confusing. So what I tried to do was to put up a biomathematician's rendition of how blood cells are actually produced. The three major types are over here, the platelets, the red cells, and the white cells. And these are circulating in the blood by and large. There are precursor cells for all three cell types. These cells in the bloodstream are no longer replicating. Okay, they have stopped replication and they're simply running around doing their housekeeping duties for the body. But there are precursor cells in the bone marrow, precursor cells for platelets, for red cells, and for white cells, that do have proliferative capabilities associated with them because there is a significant amount of amplification in all three of these precursor compartments. And these precursor compartments are in turn fed by so-called committed stem cells. So there's a cell type, a committed stem cell, that produces megakaryocytes. Megakaryocytes produce platelets. Same is true, the committed stem cells for the erythroid series, for the neutrophil series. And these three committed stem cell types are in turn the progeny of the so-called hematopoietic stem cell, or the pluripotential stem cell. And it turns out now that the hematopoietic stem cell actually is a stem cell for many other tissues in the human body. So we're learning a lot about stem cell biology, and it's going to turn out that the what goes on back here is extremely important for understanding exactly what goes on in at least two types of stem cell diseases that have a dynamic characteristic. There are other kinds of feedback in all of these control systems, because not only is there feedback at the stem cell level, regulating stem cell numbers, but there are also feedback mechanisms that are more peripherally related, and this gets to the origin of the word peripheral disease that I was talking about. For example, platelet regulation is governed primarily by a hormone called thrombopoietin. And as platelet numbers fall, thrombopoietin levels go up. This effectively triggers increased proliferative activity within the platelet precursor stem cells, this increased proliferative activity is translated into an increased efflux into the committed stem cell, committed bone marrow compartment, which is eventually translated into an increase in platelet numbers. So this is a negative feedback system. All three of these systems mediated by thrombopoietin for the platelets, erythropoietin for the red cells, and colony stimulating factor for the white cells are negative feedback systems. So from an applied mathematician standpoint, that immediately becomes of some interest. They're not only negative feedback, they're highly nonlinear. But there's a second issue that's interesting and important, and it has to do with the fact that every one of these control systems, these peripheral control systems, has a very significant time delay associated with them. So, for example, the mean time between production of a cell in the CFU Meg until you get progeny that are platelets in the circulation is on the order of 10 to 11 days. A very significant period of time. 5 to 6 days for red cells, about 7 or 8 days for the neutrophil series. And not only do you have time delays built into these systems, but there are distributions of time delays, so it's not a single delta function delay for every type of blood cell, but there's rather a distribution. And furthermore, we know that at least in some of these systems, there is a very strong state dependence because changes in the circulating numbers of red cells, for example, can have a profound effect on the length of time required for red cell precursors to actually mature to the point where they can be dumped into the circulation. So we've got an interesting sequence of mathematical problems, nonlinear negative feedback, distributions of delays, and the distributions happen to be state dependent. So there's a whole host of mathematical problems to deal with straight away off the bat. Now, if you're going to talk about diseases of peripheral control, these are diseases that I classify as peripheral in the sense that they only affect a single cell type. And the first one I want to tell you about is called cyclical thrombocytopenia, which means that your platelet count oscillates. Okay, it's just a complicated word that means that your platelet numbers go up and down. And here you see two sets of data on the left for women and the right on for men. This was all culled from the clinical literature. The person who was responsible for going through this was a student of mine, Joanna Swinburne. And okay, for here, for example, you see the platelet count in this man oscillating from virtually zero to a high of about 700 times 10 to the third per microliter, back down to zero and back up again. And on the right, what you see is a type of Fourier transforms where you're seeing power as a function of period. And in this particular person, the dominant peak in the spectrum is at 43 days. So there's this person has a period of 43 days in their platelet cycle. Up here we have somebody with a 28-day period. The horizontal dotted line, is the average platelet count. Platelet counts vary widely in normal human beings by a factor of over 2. And so you see a low here of, about 13 days in this woman right here, up to a high of, I think, somewhere 65 days or something like that. Now, originally, cyclic thrombocytopenia was thought to be something that only affected women, and it was thought to somehow be associated with the menstrual cycle, but then started being reported in males, which basically put that hypothesis to rest. And for a long time, it was not really known precisely what was going on. There have been a number of hypotheses about what the problem might be. And the danger with cyclical thrombocytopenia comes in these periods when the platelet count is very low, because oftentimes patients will have a stroke. And so a lot of people who have this disorder end up dying in one of these periods when platelet counts are very low. Now, when we went through all of the data that we had, what we found was that there was this broad range of periods between about 2 weeks and over 2 months. As far as we can tell from the clinical literature, it only affects platelets and their precursors. So the megakaryocytes, for example, also oscillate. There doesn't seem to be any prevalence, preferential prevalence between men and women. And the origin is actually quite unclear. The only clue is that there was a certain subclass of these patients in which it was reported that there might be some kind of an autoimmune component. And when we actually looked at the patients for which the clinical reports claimed a potential autoimmune component, what we found was that the periods always fell at the low end of the spectrum, namely between about 2 and 4 weeks, 13 to 27 days. Now, this is a reference here where the clinical data was actually analyzed. And then in order to try to understand what's going on from a modeling perspective, what we essentially want to do is try to concentrate on this control circuit right here, this negative feedback system right here. So we're going to assume that there's some kind of a constant input from the pluripotential stem cell compartment into the system and see whether you can actually understand precisely what's going on. And so here's just a section of that thing right there. Now, typically, when you're trying to model these systems, you can take all of these peripheral models and you can sort of view them in some sort of generic way as a balance between a production and a loss. So, for example, here, if X is the number of circulating cells, then you're losing cells at some rate gamma, right here. So this is the death from the circulation. And you're producing cells at some rate script F. And the argument of the production function has a tilde on top of it because it's not X at time T, but rather it's a rather complicated function because what you're doing is you're taking a convolution of X of T minus tau with a distribution of maturation times. And what we've discovered is that in the cases where maturation times have actually been measured, we can very accurately fit the distributions with gamma functions. And so in terms of numerics, we have been using gamma functions. Notice that if g of tau, for example, was a delta function, suppose it was a delta function at some value capital T, then this interval would just reduce to x tilde of t was x of t minus capital T. So in that sense, it's a rather more simple differential delay equation. And finally, because of the negative feedback character of the thrombopoietin pathway, as well as for erythropoietin and GCSF, these feedback functions, we are always taking them to be monotone decreasing functions, which seems to also fit the existing data relatively well. Now, I want to emphasize this is sort of a generic rendition, and if you go look at the models for platelet production that have been produced, or for red cell production, or for white cell production, you're going to find an incredible amount of detail. But I didn't want to bury you or swamp you with a lot of detail, but rather give you an overview. You can go take a look at the details later. Now, there have been two modeling attempts to look at this. The most realistic one, and the one that I'm happiest with, was published in 2000 with Jacques Belair and Moisy Santolin and Joe Mahaffey. And we came to the conclusion that for the patients that had a presumptive autoimmune component to their cyclical thrombocytopenia, that is to say, the patients with the period between 2 and 4 weeks, then this was probably caused by a supercritical Hopf bifurcation in the control system, and the supercritical Hopf bifurcation was probably induced by an elevation of the random destruction rate of platelets in the circulation. Okay, this is consistent with all the clinical findings, and it offers the analysis actually offered an interesting potential way to treat patients that had this particular form of cyclical thrombocytopenia, because it suggested that if you were able to actually increase the destruction rate further, you would have a reverse Hopf bifurcation and you would stabilize the system at a low platelet level that was significantly above zero. So the danger is, of course, when the platelet count goes to zero. If you could actually destroy the oscillation according to the model, you would stabilize at a low platelet level that would still be adequate for most daily bodily needs, but you would avoid this really catastrophic decrease to the point where you might suffer a stroke. I've not been able to interest hematologists in actually taking patients who had cyclical thrombocytopenia and actually going through a maneuver to increase platelet destruction rates. And I don't think it's too difficult to understand why they're not interested. Now, the other type, the patients that have a much longer period, we don't really know what's going on, but I suspect, although I cannot substantiate this, that it actually may be a stem cell defect. And I think you'll see the reason that I suspect a stem cell defect by the end of the talk. And I think that probably what's happened is that the oscillations in platelet counts were so dramatic and so in your face that people never actually bothered to look at neutrophil counts and red cell precursor counts and lymphocyte counts in these patients. A second type of disease that involves peripheral control is so-called periodic hemolytic anemia or periodic autoimmune hemolytic anemia. This is an extremely rare disorder in humans. It's very, very few case studies have actually been published, primarily because of this architecture of the red cell production system. In humans, normal red cells live in the circulation for about 120 days, and this offers a huge damping to any kind of oscillation that might be entering from the bone marrow. You can think about oscillating water in one end of a baby bathtub with your finger. You can see the oscillation at the other end. But if you go to an Olympic-sized swimming pool and oscillate the water at one end with your finger, you're not going to see anything at the other end. You won't see anything anywhere, for that matter. So it offers a huge reservoir which effectively damps out these oscillations, but it has been seen in some patients who have drastically shortened red cell survival. It can be induced in laboratory animals, and here is a beautiful example from a paper in the 1960s by Kirk, Orr, and Hope that was published in the British Journal of Hematology. And what they did was to raise a red cell isoantibody for rabbits. So they would take rabbits, raise an isoantibody against their own red cells, and then they would inject the isoantibody. And what they found was that instead of having a nice, relatively constant number of red cell precursors, the reticulocytes, and having a fairly constant level of hemoglobin in the blood, they got this absolutely beautiful oscillation with a period of about 16 to 17 days, not only in the reticulocyte count, but also in the hemoglobin level. So the question is, what's going on? Well, again, if you take precisely the same kind of generic model that I've been talking about, but sexed up a bit to include all the red cell physiology that you know is important, then you can put together a relatively reasonable model, and you can actually account for all the characteristics that you see in autoimmune hemolytic anemia in the few clinical cases that we know of, as well as in the laboratory animal. And the key to the whole thing is that the autoimmune effect effectively elevates the random destruction rate of the red cells in the circulation. And when you take this into account, so what we're doing is we're elevating the death rate of red cells, no matter what age they happen to be in the circulation. And the consequence of this is that it induces, again, a supercritical Hopf bifurcation because of the elevation in the death rate, and you can predict the period extremely accurately. And it matches precisely with what you see clinically, and it matches with what you see experimentally. And the most accurate rendition of that model was this paper in 1978 that was published in the Journal of Theoretical Biology. So here we have two examples of diseases where it looks like there's a bifurcation in the stability of the peripheral control loop that leads actually to manifestations you can either see clinically or in the laboratory. Now, a third example, a putative example of a peripheral control system gone awry is cyclical neutropenia. This has been the darling of mathematical biologists for a long time. And I'll tell you a little bit about the disease first. This is a patient, Mrs. H, who was studied by my colleague David Dale back in the 1970s when we were both young and full of energy. David was a young resident at the National Institutes of Health at the time, and I was in the U.S. Navy at the time, but we didn't know each other. And a woman was admitted to the clinical center from Tennessee, I believe. Her physician had diagnosed her as having cyclical neutropenia, and here you can see the hallmark of cyclical neutropenia because her white cell count goes from about 2,000 per cc down to zero, and then back up and back down, up and down and up and down, with a period of about 3 weeks. And see, this goes on for a period of 210 days. This disease was first described back in the 1880s by a German hematologist and acquired the name of cyclical neutropenia because of this characteristic oscillation. Again, if you look at the long periodogram analysis, this Fourier analysis, spectral analysis, then you find that there's a highly significant peak in the power of her neutrophil count at a frequency of 0.05, which would correspond to 20 days. Now, the interesting thing is when you look at some of the other blood cell counts from this woman that David collected and published in Blood, there's the hint that maybe there's some oscillation in those also. And when we actually got hold of the original data with great difficulty, what we found was that indeed there's a significant oscillation in the lymphocytes at virtually the same period, in the monocytes. There's two significant peaks in the power in the platelets, but at quite different frequencies. This is the only patient like this we've ever seen. We have no idea what's going on. And also a peak in the reticulocyte oscillation right here at the 20 days, and another significant peak down here at a much lower frequency or higher period. So one of the hallmarks of cyclical neutropenia is not only this oscillation in the neutrophil count, but also an oscillation in apparently all of the formed elements of the blood. So we see it in the monocytes, the lymphocytes, the red cell precursors, etc. I was very fortunate to make contact with David Dale in 1993, and at that time he was running a clinical trial for Amgen for granulocyte colony stimulating factor, and they were interested in trying to look at the effects of GCSF on patients that were neutropenic. And so they had collected a large patient population from across the United States. And here are the power spectra for 10 different patients. And what I want to do, so the top row are the neutrophils and lymphocytes, monocytes, and platelets. And what you see in this particular patient, for example, is significant peak in the power in the platelets at about probably 25 days. Something in the monocytes that's not statistically significant but still there, nothing obvious in the lymphocytes, and something in the neutrophils that's also not statistically significant. And yet this patient had been classified by their physician as a patient with cyclical neutropenia. Here's another example, patient 43, highly significant oscillations in the neutrophil count, below significant power in the lymphocytes, the monocytes, and the platelets. And this is the pattern we always see. Even if the peak in the power spectrum isn't significant, it always shows up at precisely the same period or the same frequency as the ones that are significant. So study of this disease has been greatly aided by the fact that there's a naturally occurring animal model. It's the so-called gray collie. And here you see on the right a normal collie puppy. This guy's got black and white and brown fur, a little brown here on his paws. And this is one of his litter mates who is a gray collie, and the litter mate is only white and black. His other gray collies are completely gray. Now, the hallmark of gray collies is that they always, always, always have cyclical neutropenia. Absolutely always, without fail. It's genetically determined. Now, most dog breeders, if they end up with a gray collie and a litter of pups will drown it when it's born because they know that the dog is going to eventually die, probably from pneumonia or something like that, within a couple of weeks. David Dale, on the other hand, had the foresight and the good luck to get a substantial amount of money from the NIH, and he has kept a colony of gray collies in Seattle for over 25 years. And so this is a marvelous experimental resource with which to actually try to understand this disease. We know that the disease is resident in the bone marrow. There's a defect in the bone marrow that's actually giving rise to this, because if you take this gray collie pup and lethally irradiate him and then do a bone marrow transplant from his normal litter mate, he's totally normal, hematologically normal. On the other hand, if you take this guy and lethally irradiate him to kill all the cells in his bone marrow and then do a bone marrow transplant from his gray collie litter mate, then he's going to have cyclical neutropenia. Okay? So there's something within the bone marrow population itself that carries the defect. And if you look at data from gray collies, it's qualitatively identical to what you see in humans. The difference is quantitative. So here on the left, I have cell counts from neutrophils, platelets, monocytes, lymphocytes, and eosinophils in the gray collie. And on the right, you see the periodogram analysis. The only thing that's different is that the period in the gray collie tends to be shorter. So whereas humans tend to have oscillations on the order of about 21 days on average, although there's a fairly broad range, the dogs have oscillations that are much shorter in period, typically around 10 to 13 or 14 days. So that's the only difference, and it's a quantitative difference. Qualitatively, it's all the same. You always see oscillations in all cell types. And I want to draw your attention to one interesting feature here on the left. If you look in the cell count data, you'll see that I've actually ranked them so that the dog on the left, dog 127, had the lowest amplitude oscillation in his neutrophil count, and the oscillation amplitude progressively increases to the right for dog 100. And notice, this is going to come up in a few minutes, notice that as the amplitude of the oscillation gets larger, then on the falling phase of the neutrophil count, there's always the secondary bump that shows up. See that? Can you see that or not? Or is it too faint? Oliver's not convinced. Anyway, take my word for it, it's there. So, if you want to try to understand what's going on, you have to look at this again as a control problem. And the first hypothesis was that this was actually a defect in peripheral control, namely that there was some kind of an instability in this feedback system mediated by granulocyte colony stimulating factor that was causing the oscillation. The hypothesis that this was the case was a reasonable one, because the oscillation for humans has a period of about 21 days. We know that the length of time required to traverse this entire maturation pathway is on the order of 5 to 6 days. Anybody who studied differential Lillet equations knows that oftentimes when you get bifurcations, when you get a Hopf bifurcation, under certain circumstances, the period of the oscillation will be greater than twice the delay, and depending upon the nature of the feedback, can be bounded above by 4 times the delay. So it was a natural hypothesis. However, if you put together a very detailed model for peripheral regulation of neutrophil production, you can estimate all the parameters, and what it turns out is that if you want to predict the correct amplitude for the neutrophil oscillations, the periods are incorrect, but if you set up the system so that it predicts the correct periods, the amplitudes are wrong. And furthermore, it predicts an absolutely abnormal response of the system to GCSF, granulocyte colony stimulating factor. The only thing that's great about this particular model is that if you actually assume that you have an oscillatory input from the hematopoietic stem cells, that is to say, if you assume that you have a flux of cells coming in here that's oscillating. So for example, if this became unstable and there was an oscillatory efflux into the platelet line, the red cell line, as well as the neutrophil line, under that hypothesis, then this model that you put together for the lower control system makes some very interesting predictions. Because here you see at the top are the not only the data from the gray collies that I showed you on the previous slide, ranging from dog 127 here over to 100. So the data are the x's, and the solid line is the predicted response from the model. The only thing that it's done is to increase the amplitude of the input from the hypothetical amplitude from the hematopoietic stem cell compartment. And here you see the predicted power versus the power that was actually measured experimentally. And the thing that's really neat about this, I think, is the following. Because here you see you're starting to pick up the secondary bump on the falling phase of the neutrophil count, and it depends upon the amplitude. And so here you see it very prominently. And so what I thought was originally a secondary bifurcation in the experimental data in the was actually not that at all. It's simply the response of a highly nonlinear system to a periodic forcing. And so you're getting the secondary bump showing up, and see that it's always associated with this secondary peak in the frequency at twice the frequency at which you have the original power. So under the hypothesis that you have an oscillation coming from the stem cell compartment, you can actually explain the characteristics that you see in the periphery. You have that laser pointer? Mine has just died. I loaned it to too many people. So this hypothesis brings us back, this hypothesis in conjunction with, thank you very much. Yeah, that's mine. You can't. Oh, there's one on here? Really? So the hypothesis that you've got an oscillatory input combined with the modeling that I've just shown you, in conjunction with experimental and clinical data on bone marrow transplant and a whole variety of other things, makes it interesting to try to look at this as a disease involving the stem cells itself. And quite frankly, there were no hematologists who ever thought that this was a defect in this control loop at all. It was always the biomathematicians who thought it was. The hematologist said, okay, look, you've got oscillations here, 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 and here. They all have the same period. It seems to us that the most likely and parsimonious assumption is that the oscillation is coming out of the stem cell compartment. Well, if you try to follow that up in a quantitative fashion, basically what you have to do is construct a model for the regulation of the stem cells themselves. And we have used a relatively crude model. I think it may be relatively crude, but I think it's consistent with the existing data that we have available. We divide cells into two functional categories, namely proliferating phase cells. These are cells that are involved in DNA synthesis, the G2 phase of the cell cycle, mitosis, and then following mitosis and cytokinesis, two daughter cells are dumped into a resting phase, so-called resting phase of the cell cycle. And cells in the resting phase have one of three fates available to them. They can either sit there for a very long time, all the neurons in your nervous system are sitting in a G0 phase, the ones that haven't actually died, or they can differentiate, or they can actually re-enter the proliferative phase to go through another round and produce two more daughter cells. There are control mechanisms involved in this whole system. Number one, the rate of cellular re-entry into the proliferative phase from G0 is known to be a nonlinear function of the number of cells in the population. So that when the population numbers are low, beta is high. When the numbers are high, beta is low. So beta is actually a monotone decreasing function. The second thing, which will actually turn out to be highly important, is the fact that cells in the proliferative phase can actually be removed through apoptosis or programmed cell death. And the final thing that's important in terms of trying to understand the dynamics of the system is that in the hematopoietic stem cell compartment, there is a significant period of time between when a cell initiates DNA synthesis and when two daughter cells are produced. Our estimates from data in the mouse and in the cat are that this cell cycle time, the average, is on the order of about 2 to 4 days. So it's a very long period of time, much longer than the duration of the proliferative phase in peripheral and highly differentiated tissues like liver, skin, etc., gut. So the types of governing equations that you write down are essentially balance equations precisely of the form that you had for the peripheral control models. And we'll just take a look here. The first term here is the N is the number of G0 phase cells. And so the first term here just talks about the loss of G0 phase cells. So the delta M term is the differentiation into all the formed elements of the blood. The beta times N is the loss back into the proliferative phase. So those are the loss terms. And then we have an input right here, and this is that input term right there. And it's relatively easy to understand where all these factors come from. If there was no cell death, no apoptosis in the proliferative phase, then the flux into G0 from here would be 2 times what had come in here, a time tau in the past, where tau is the length of time required to go through the proliferative phase. So we have 2 times beta, with the argument evaluated at t minus tau, times the number of cells you had at t minus tau. But if you have apoptosis taking place, then there's also a random cell death during this period of time tau, and this gives rise to this exponential prefactor e to the minus gamma tau. So that's where the terms come from. So we've got a number of parameters. We have a differentiation rate. We have a time tau required to traverse the proliferative phase. We have a measure for the rate of apoptosis, et cetera. An analysis of this model indicates something rather interesting. Namely, if you hold all the parameters at their value that you estimate for humans and look at the efflux. This is the flux into the platelet plus red cell plus neutrophil line. So the total efflux as a function of the rate of apoptosis. What you find is the following. If you are on this particular curve here, then the efflux is a smooth monotone decreasing function of the rate of cell death, until finally you get to this point right here and the cell death rate is so high that the population can no longer sustain itself and it goes extinct. On the other hand, if you are on this line right here and you increase the apoptosis rate, you come down smoothly until this point right here, at which point there is again a supercritical Hopf bifurcation and you have a Hopf period at this point of 19 days. As you go through this zone, the amplitude of the oscillation increases and then decreases. And finally, at this point right here, there's a reverse bifurcation, and the Hopf period at that reverse bifurcation is 25 days. Well, if you look at this entire ensemble of predicted Hopf periods, they fall precisely in the range that we see for patients that have cyclical neutropenia. So the hypothesis is that in point of fact, cyclical neutropenia in humans is due to an abnormally high rate of apoptosis. And precisely the same conclusions are found if you use estimates for the stem cell compartment from dogs, except now what you're seeing is a lower period. I've never actually seen a dog with a period as high as 26 days or even 20 days. But the notion is the same, that it's actually elevated apoptosis levels in the bone marrow that are giving rise to cyclical neutropenia. So, isn't that strange? My fonts have all changed. Okay. Doesn't matter. So the prediction, if you want to just have a little schematic diagram, the prediction is that you should have this deflux in the, or decrease in the efflux, increase in the amplitude, then decreases, gamma increases, and the period increases. And I'm going to go fast because I, what time am I supposed to stop? Like 2 minutes ago? Okay, I'm going to go really quick. The bottom line of the story is the following. You can reverse the effects of apoptosis by using the natural cytokine that controls neutrophil production. Granulocyte colony stimulating factor decreases apoptosis, not only in neutrophil precursors, but also in the stem cells. So, what this predicts is that if you were able to decrease the level of apoptosis, you should increase the mean value of the neutrophil oscillation, you should increase the amplitude, and you should decrease the period. Bottom line is, that's exactly what happens when you treat patients that have cyclical neutropenia. And I'm going to flip through this, because what you find is you increase the amplitude and the mean value of the oscillation, the period goes down, and the further prediction is that if you give enough of GCSF that you should actually be able to reverse the bifurcation and stop the oscillation, and you see this exactly in gray colonies. There's a recent paper of cyclical neutropenia in the Journal of Theoretical Biology, 2003, that you can take a look and see more advanced examples of this. I'm not going to tell you about periodic leukemia, although I think it's fascinating. We're studying it. I don't understand it. And the fact that we cannot account for what goes on in periodic leukemia, I think, is an indication of the fact that, as in my talk on Monday, I said there was something missing in the biology. I think there's something missing here. There's something about the regulation of the hematopoietic stem cell compartment that we do not understand. So, there are a variety of hematological diseases. Some involve peripheral destabilization. Others involve destabilization of control at the stem cell level. The interesting thing is that all of them seem to be somehow related to cellular destruction mechanisms. Doesn't matter if it's an autoimmune effect or if it happens to be involved with apoptosis. I'd like to mention my collaborators. This is a work that's been going on for close to 30 years. Been many people involved. I didn't have pictures of everybody, but the people I did have pictures of, I put up here. And finally, I would just like to make a little advertisement that the CNNDia in Montreal is going to run a summer school in May of 2004. If you're interested, take a look at our website for details in the next few weeks. And for students from Canada who are associated with MyTax projects, there will be partial support for local expenses and travel expenses for up to about 10 MyTax-related students. So thank you very much. Thank you.